Did you know that collagen makes up 30% of the protein in your body? It's the substance that gives structure, support, and strength to your skin, muscles, bones, and connective tissues. Collagen is what keeps our skin firm and youthful, preventing it from sagging. It also supplies amino acids that are crucial for building healthy hair and protecting hair follicles. The collagen supplement that I use and recommend to my patients is Revive by Bright Core Nutrition. Revive combines five types of collagen with hyaluronic acid and biotin to heal and nourish your skin, hair, and nails. Studies show that collagen also helps relieve joint inflammation and pain. If you're looking to heal your body from the inside out and reverse some effects of aging, Revive could be your answer. For more information and to order, visit mybrightcore.com/Hoffman. That's mybrightcore.com/Hoffman or call 888-592-9909. That's 888-592-9909. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, buy two bottles of Revive and get one free, plus a collagen sheet mask as a free gift. That's mybrightcore.com/Hoffman for Revive Multi-Collagen Protein. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. They say that turnaround is fair play, and therefore I am interviewing one of my favorite guests, Dr. Gio Espinosa. He is a well-known naturopathic doctor, unique among naturopathic doctors, because he is an integrative urologist. That is a claim to fame, because there's not... They are very few and far between. He is also a licensed acupuncturist and a certified functional medicine practitioner. And he recently interviewed me for an upcoming prostate cancer summit that we want to alert you to. That will take place on November 19th. And so there's a lot of useful information there for men who are concerned about prostate cancer, men who are suffering from prostate cancer, and of course, significant others in their lives who have to live with this condition as well. So, Gio, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. I always look forward to the opportunity because you are so knowledgeable on matters urological.
Rod, it's always a pleasure. It's been a while, I have to say. It's been a while since I've been on your show. But the times that I've been on your show has been such a pleasure because I think your audience should know, first of all, you've had your show for a long time, way before I even thought, I believe, of becoming a practitioner myself. And I remember back in the day, listening to your show, and I think you played a big role, little do you know, inspiring me to do the work that I do in integrative and holistic medicine. Of course, I chose the road less traveled. I said, well, you know, I'm not sure that I'm good enough to see all the conditions. Let me just focus in this one little gland, mm-hmm. this one little area, and try to be the best I could there. But I've been listening to your show for, I want to say, over 30 years. And it's still one of the best shows on integrative medicine. I want to thank you for that. And it's always a pleasure to know you, call you a friend and be on your show.
Well, indeed, that is very, very gratifying because legacy is important to me at this point in my career. And it's just really nice to know that there's some really, really brilliant and knowledgeable practitioners who are carrying on with the legacy of the work that we do. But I wanted to ask you, because you are a very interesting bird, because you are part of the faculty at NYU, and New York University is a conservative institution. I know, because part of my residency, I served at NYU back in the 1980s at the height of the HIV AIDS epidemic. And so those were crazy days that I spent, you know, sleepless nights at NYU. And in those days, integrative medicine was not really that acceptable. an interesting thing happened, befell me in relationship to NYU. When I was embarking on my career, and I was kind of well on my way in my career, I'd established myself as an integrative physician. I was invited by the residents at NYU. This is in the 1990s, to speak to them. And at the time, the head of medicine over at NYU was a guy named Dr. Farber. Dr. Farber was in charge when I was there. And things were so conservative at that point in time that Dr. Farber put the kibosh on my presentation to residents at NYU. He said, "Ron Hoffman, that guy, I'm not having that guy speak to my doctors." Mm-hmm. And so that was the 1990s. Fast forward to the present, and I know you've been there for a while, since perhaps the early to mid 2000s. You were a naturopathic physician. And naturopathic physicians, you know, I got to share with you, it remains kind of a controversial discipline. And I'm going to share with you a quote from Wikipedia, which you may be well aware of, Wikipedia being a highly captured source of information, or in this case, disinformation. This is what Wikipedia says about your discipline, naturopathic medicine. It says, quote, "A wide array of pseudoscientific practices branded as, quote, natural," I think those are Dr. Evil quotes, "non-invasive or promoting self-healing," again in Dr. Evil quotes, "are employed by its practitioners. The ethics of naturopathy have been called into question by medical professionals, and its practice has been characterized as quackery." So here we are with a unique situation where NYU, with its conservative background, has embraced your approach, and kudos to you for perhaps representing naturopathy as the best of both worlds, with a real scientific underpinning, with a rigorous adherence to best practices in medicine, and yet they've incorporated you as part of their program of urology. So explain how that happened and how you fit into that. That is an interesting story in itself, I think.
So just like back in the day when it's, we're not having this guy here anymore, you know, we're not going to have this guy talk to our doctors. I've been feeling that's going to happen to me since day one. This GOS, but he's a natural, you know, with even mispronunciation of the word back then. He's a natural, who, what? What is this guy doing here? What are we doing? Get this guy out of here.
Right.
And I'm still waiting for that period after 15 years.
The proverbial sword of Damocles is hanging over your head.
Exactly. Fast forward 2024, 15 years later, and thank God I'm an integral part of the department. Ranked number two in the country out of, you know, thousands of urology department, I must say, a little bragging right. Of course, it has everything to do with me and the fact that they have enough.
You push them up the ladder of
that piece in Wikipedia is definitely disinformation and misinformation. I'm wondering how often they update the information, because I think at this point, it's common knowledge that many natural therapies. Let's go back in a day, naturopathic, how did it all begin, right?
Yeah.
We're talking over, you know, 100 years ago, mid-1800s, late-1800s, early 1900s, where naturopathic medicine was mostly sun therapy, hydrotherapy, and fasting.
Right.
Wow, what quackery. Fasting, right. But sun therapy, and hydrotherapy. But England talks about now, everybody, right, with their cold plunges.
Exactly. It's accepted.
And sun therapy, knowing what the importance of vitamin D, and not only even vitamin D, just important to sunlight overall and for mood, fasting, a lot of research on fasting. So if we just go there, there's tons of evidence as it relates to naturopathic medicine.
But in some ways, I believe that naturopathic medicine was applied as a a bit of a correction to what was then termed heroic medicine, which was bleeding, the use of things like calomel, which is a mercury compound, which actually hastened the demise of a lot of people. Medicine in the, 1700s and 1800s was very extreme before so-called scientific medicine.
It was barbaric.
Right.
People's heads for the spirits to come out and all sorts of things like that. It was barbaric.
So naturopathic now medicine actually was more of a, in a way, a more a sensible approach based on traditional medical practices that were gentler in a way.
Correct. And then the naturopaths back in those days and the herbalists that were all medical doctors learned about, wow, these herbs are, there's something to these herbs. By the way, these herbs, right? And now we know that there's science between these herbs and in these herbs, there are science and medicinal mushrooms. Now even psychedelics, there's a lot of science behind that. Cannabis, everybody, is a big thing now. So then the botanical medicine became part of the repertoire for naturopathic doctors, along with lifestyle practices, all science, exercise, all the things, right? That not only did we always know it worked, but now there's a plethora of evidence and science to support the use of all these things. I always go back to the water therapy, because I have a book back here on naturopathic hydrotherapy. This book was written in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there's so much knowledge and science and interest in this, and almost everyone I know has a water plunge in their house somewhere, it's outstanding. So yeah, that's outdated, and that's definitely disinformation. But at this point, I think the word is out there. And if I may say one other thing, because this actually, you always want to know, how does this ever happen? Why is naturopathic medicine was a big thing in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Well, in 1909, the Flexner Report was written, and that pretty much said that, anything other than standard medicine is quackery and it cannot be in any of the schools.
It's been branded monopolistic and a clear example of restraint of trade, because what has happened is mainstream medicine has sort of precluded some of the other disciplines that used to, in effect, compete with it. And so we have chiropractors being branded as quacks. We have acupuncturists being branded as quacks. Naturopaths not achieving licensure in some states, although some states are accepting of naturopaths. And so, it's a classic example of, let's edge out the competition, in effect.
And only pharmaceuticals and surgery, these are the things that was heavily funded by Rockefeller. And then, the surgeon Halsted from Hopkins, who happened to be a coke addict and a morphine addict, was involved in that process, along with the Rockefellers. And then it got rid of, all the other types, as you mentioned, it monopolized medicine. Here we are now, fast forward 2024. And look, there's a lot of trust issues as it relates to medicine and medical doctors. And something that I'm not happy about, because, many physicians, certainly the ones I know, do great work. Certainly after COVID, there's a lot of misinformation and distrust, I would say, about medicine and medical doctors. So now here I am at NYU. It's almost like a marketing thing also. It's like, wait a minute, we do have a naturopath here, by the way.
Well,
what is it? To holistic medicine and natural. We do have one of the, by the way, we have one of those here.
In a way, it's kind of the greening of the Department of Urology, is that they, I think they recognize that the public expects a natural or holistic perspective. And I think that's what you bring to the fore there. But, I would say that among the different disciplines, gastroenterology, it's clear diet makes a difference. Cardiology, it's clear, with metabolic diseases rampant, and obesity and high cholesterol and all these things, insulin resistance contributing to cardiovascular disease, I could see a place for a naturopathic physician. But it's kind of interesting that urology now has become a front line for application of natural approaches, you know, diet, lifestyle, natural supplements. It's kind of interesting that this is coming into the fore, because this is, you know, used to be a field where it was really all about, you know, let's do surgery, let's do radiation when it comes to urological problems. There's more to it than that, right?
Particularly in certain, so here's how it all happened, Ron. The next question, why urology? How did this all?
Yep.
Ron, there are conditions within urology that you know about that they don't want to deal with because there's no solution for it. Yep. There's no surgery or valid pharmaceutical. This is things like, I call it pelvic itis because I think prostatitis is just a diagnosis of exclusion and not a real diagnosis. So pelvic itis, which is like any inflammation or inflammatory types of symptoms in a pelvic area. So once I also presented, this was even before NYU, because I started at Columbia.
Right.
With Aaron Katz, and who really started my career. That's where my career began. I said, look, I'll see every prostatitis patient and they'll never have to go back to you again.
Hired. Give this guy.
Right.
Well, give this guy a room. Get back then, give him an office, whatever he wants, you know. So that was, at Columbia, I kind of learned the game a little bit.
Right.
This is what they, yeah, don't mess with, don't tell anyone they don't need surgery.
Yeah.
That's not the thing. Well, now we know active surveillance, which we'll talk about things like that.
Yes.
But prostatitis? Oh, yeah, and all yours. Yeah, we don't do. You can cure prostatitis with natural medicine. We don't want anything to do with it. So that was, that helped me in.
So that was really the entry point, because it was like, oh my God, all these patients are up these vague symptoms. I can't make them any better. Turf to Dr. Espinosa. He'll deal with those people who are they're just the dead end cases, the problem cases for whom we don't have answers. And so that carved a niche for you. But I think it was already in the Columbia days that a new concept developed, which is you have cancer, let's just do watchful waiting. And then with your collaboration with Dr. Aaron Katz, a new term developed, which is active holistic surveillance. And this notion is like, you've got cancer and we're going to just like not do anything about it? No, we're actually going to do something about it. We're going to make some major lifestyle changes. We're going to keep an eye on the cancer. We may eventually have to treat it with conventional treatments, but this has now become accepted, which is just so exciting. It really creates an entree for the Prostate Cancer Summit that you're going to be presiding over on November 19th. This is a whole new perspective on a form of cancer where lifestyle makes a difference.
Not only does lifestyle make a difference, but now, Ron, you know the story. Men don't really want to be healthier or do things to be healthier. Men do things because either their mortality is on the line or they want to improve performance. So, hey, go exercise, eat better, lose some weight, because you're going to get healthier. That's not motivating for them. The word cancer is motivating. So active surveillance is absolutely, or let's just say low-grade prostate cancer, is the absolute best diagnosis, I believe, that a man can have, because they are unlikely to die from their, I can't even call it a disease, because some of the experts are even debating whether we should call it cancer or not, actually, today. But it's the C word. If there's any real good reason to call it cancer, it's because men get motivated and they actually are able to do all the things that now their health becomes better at whatever age, 50, 60, 70, than they experienced a decade before.
So it's a teachable moment.
It's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity that they've never experienced before. And now it gives us a better conversation. They do all the things. It's the most unbelievable thing I've seen. And yes, oftentimes, look, in my practice, they've had prostate cancer on a low risk disease. Fast forward a year later, they get on a protocol, they do a biopsy, and oftentimes no cancer is found.
Mm-hmm.
At worst, it stays stable.
Right.
Often, and one can argue, and this is a reason why I don't go to the internet and say, I cure prostate cancer, because I think that's irresponsible. B, there's always the possibility of missing the tumor you found a year ago through the biopsy. But if your MRI is the same, the surgeon or the urologist who performed the biopsy the first time is the same the second time, and your PSA drops, you could take that to the bank. I can't say that you're cured, but I can say that, look, there's likely nothing happening here. It's certainly no progression, and likely you'll never have to get biopsied again.
Can we explore the origins of active holistic surveillance, and what is the use case for active holistic surveillance? Because it seems to me that there are various forms of, let's put it in quotation marks, prostate cancer. There's prostate cancer, which is discovered, unfortunately, when it's widely metastatic and you're off to the races for, you know, very, very radical treatment that ultimately may or may not be successful. It may, you know, delay the progression of the disease, but we don't have a cure. Then there's localized prostate cancer, which is pretty bad, and maybe a good idea to excise it with surgery or treat it with radiation, and that may improve survival. But there's a certain category where so-called prostate cancer is discovered. There's aberrant scales, cells, there's a Gleason score where we can say, don't just stand there, do nothing. Or do something, but do all the affirmative things, but not conventional treatment.
Right. Just sit there, do nothing kind of thing, or be proactive.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a phenomenon. Now there's over 20 years data showing that that there's no difference between the group that has a certain risk, a certain grade of prostate cancer, whether they do surgery, whether they do radiation or do nothing, in terms of mortality within certain years of time. The data is pretty abundant now. So then the question is, you know, who's that candidate? And that's a little bit of a lengthy conversation, but what I'll say is what happens is that when the patient gets a biopsy, then the pathologist looks at the biopsy tissue and they graded a Gleason score. So there's a couple of issues there. Number one is that the pathologist is a human, is not a robot yet.
Well, it's a human. AI may change that, you know.
Oh yeah, it's gonna change the whole game with that. But it's currently a human reading it and say, yeah, Gleason score. What's a Gleason score? It's a score that compares the tissue and how the architecture of that tissue compared to the architecture of normal tissue. So based on how abnormal it looks, it gives it a Gleason score. There's two numbers that are combined. So it's either a Gleason 6, 3 plus 3, 7, 3 plus 4, 4 plus 3, 8, 9, or 10. The higher the Gleason score, the more abnormal, or the architecture of that tissue looks more abnormal compared to normal tissue. So the argument is that
does it also speak to the number of sites where it is present or the extent to which it invades the prostate? One of the numbers?
Correct. Okay. Currently, so the numbers mean there's two separate numbers. One is, what is the most abnormal architecture? And what is that number? The most abnormal architecture from this biopsy, let's say it's a Gleason 7. The most abnormal architecture is a 4. The second most abnormal is a 3.
Okay.
Or it could be the other way around. The most abnormal architecture is a 3, and then the second most abnormal is a 4. And that does make a difference in a Gleason 7, because that changes from low intermediate risk with the person who has Gleason 7, 3 plus 4, to high intermediate risk in the person who's 4 plus 3, because the more abnormal in a 4 plus 3 is a Gleason 4, is a 4 number. So that those nuances do actually make a difference.
Could the second number be higher, like a 4 plus 4 or a 4 plus 5, or, you know,
Once a Gleason score is 4 plus 3 or higher, then it really doesn't matter that much.
Okay. So that's the cutoff. 7 Seven requires action. Seven requires action.
Not if it's a Gleason 7 lower intermediate risk 3+4.
Okay.
Not, and we can get into the weeds here, but this is fascinating. Okay, we know Gleason 6.
Because I used to think that the cutoff was 7. Gleason 6, you know, we could do the watchful waiting or the active holistic surveillance. Now Gleason 7. So there's almost a creep towards conservatism and towards pausing very radical treatment.
Correct. And they're taking this, the people that are serious are taking this seriously. There are those that, you know, and this is part of the cynicism, is like, okay, how many kids do you have in college? Because I got a Gleason 6 and here you are recommending me to get a prostatectomy. What's happening here? And, you know, the patient is informed that this information is out there through all the media.
What you're saying is that there is disparities among urologists. Some urologists are perhaps paying more attention to the latest science, and others are kind of old school. They're going, hey, you know, you're better off without it. You know, we'll treat it. But you're almost implying that could be a little bit of an economic incentive. And, we got to admit that is possibly the case in medicine.
Why wouldn't it be? Let's just be honest.
Yeah.
They're incentive. And I'm not saying that in any disparaging way. Yeah. I work with the best urologists around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm super fortunate to do so because these are not those guys. And I have to say,
they're thoughtful urologists. They're following the science. Yeah.
NYU, Sloan, Weill, Columbia, these are all phenomenal. And just not in New York, there's plenty of those that are responsible and will only suggest treatment and those that actually need it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, when they come to my office, because they come to me also to be their prostate cancer navigator at times. Hey, help me out here. This is very confusing to me.
Right. A lot of decisions.
There's a lot of decisions. Prostate, I don't want my prostate removed, but they're saying my prostate should be removed. So then I have a system of how to decipher how to do that. But oftentimes I see Gleason 6s that they're suggesting surgery still.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is that Gleason 6 is definitely active surveillance. And much of Gleason 7, 3+4, can be on active surveillance. It also depends on volume per tissue that is actually that has cancer.
So okay. And that's not factored into the Gleason score?
That is factored in the second part.
The second part. Okay. The
correct. It's always factored in.
Okay.
In every biopsy report. And it's definitely factored in the Gleason 7 scenario, where if there's 3+4, but there's high volume, then that's debatable. But now there's also, Ron, now there's also genetic testing.
Right.
Where you take the tissue and they give you a score. So that was the other thing. The MRI actually helps quite a bit to determine if it's outside the prostate or in the prostate. Just if you have to, one out of six people get prostate cancer within a lifetime, still about 30,000 people die from it. These are men, of course, in the US. But I have to say, if you have to have a cancer as a man, probably prostate cancer is the best type to have. And if you have to have it in any moment in time, the best time is now, because just the technology has evolved pretty drastically.
We're going to talk about some of the innovations, but as our listeners know, we divide our podcast into two parts. So great introduction. We got lots more to discuss when it comes to prostate health for men. That's going to be the subject of an upcoming summit that you don't want to miss. It's the Prostate Cancer Summit you are curating experts on this subject from around the world. I'm privileged to say that I was part of the conversation. We had a great interview that's going to be part of the Prostate Cancer Summit. That's going to drop on November 19th. So what's the heads up on how to sign up for that?
Ron, let me just say this first. I mean, I wake up and I'm like, I'm the most lucky person I know. I'm the luckiest person in the world, because I get to have these conversations with luminaries through my podcast and then the summit. You came on again. I always appreciate my relationship with you. And yes, you were on talking about your approaches with prostate problems and prostate cancer. As one who
you've been around the block a little bit and you have a lot of experience.
It's evolved. It's certainly evolved. Yeah.
Very, yeah, it has. There's about 40 people interviewed, luminaries around from around the world. And we cover everything from all sorts of, how do you diagnose it? The best form of diagnosis, what are all the tools that are out there, the genomics that's out there. We cover, PSA, what do we do with this thing at this point? You know, we say it stands for patient-stimulated anxiety.
That's good.
There's a reason why we say that. You know, what do we do with this biomarker now? And how do we best utilize other tools that we have? This urine test that is more sensitive and specific to prostate cancer. Once you're diagnosed, what are my real options? Other than surgery and radiation, there's focal therapies. So we cover that with, you know, best of the best in the space. We also have, you know, Jonathan Haas, who's a radiation oncologist, very thoughtful person. I would send a family member to him. Yep. He is a radiation oncologist at NYU, very thoughtful.
Yeah,
he
does something called he's the physician for some of my patients with prostate problems. So, and he's very highly regarded.
Highly regarded. Then in the space of natural medicine, we still disagree with Wikipedia, we all have to admit there's a couple of people in our field that I was like, oh man, what are you doing there? I don't know about your foot baths, detoxifying your body and all sorts of other things, right? Some of the things that in our field are questionable. Only the best are in this summit talking about their expertise, whether it's IV vitamin C, does it work or doesn't it work? The metabolism of cancer. We have Thomas Seyfried from Boston
Wonderful.
College.
Yeah.
He came, you know,
the metabolic theory of cancer, the author of that whole premise.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which, again, it's Nisha Winters, who's written The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. Dr. Paul Anderson, naturopath or holistic thinkers that, supplements. What's the story with supplements,
right?
Dietary supplements? What work, you know, all of our patients are taking tons of things, and is it working? So we cover the full spectrum, and I think those of your audience is going to really find it fascinating. So it is November 19th. It's all online. It's free. And it's the Prostate Cancer Summit through Dr. Talks. If they also go to my website, they'll see it there, drgeo.com.
drgeo.com.
That's correct.
Great. All right. We've got a lot more to talk about, so hang in there. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Dr. Gio Espinosa, America's leading integrative naturopathic urologist, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.